When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's up, man?
Hey, I'm all right. About the same as last week, I think.
He remains unremarkable, folks. this is episode 302. It's our July 2024 research review. We've got all the goodies in this one. We've got a mystery case. We've got Quack Watch. We've got some of the latest science to come out. And we're going to review them for you right here on this podcast. But before we get into that, just a reminder, we do have a number of great resources that we just released on our website and on the Google Play app. So first, we have a number of tools on our resource page. So we've got a calorie calculator, macronutrient calculator, cardiorespiratory fitness training zones. If you're a zone, you know, two type person, you want to get into that or figure out what the heart rates are, we've got that available. Just head over to our website, click on About Us, go to the resources tab, and it's all there for free. If you're a green bubble person, that means you're one of the, I think it's like 60% of the world's population has an Android smartphone. Well, look, we're finally out on the Google Play Store. You can download the Barbell Medicine app for free. All of our templates are available on there right now, with the first week being free. If you want to check out some of our templates, including the pain and rehab stuff. And then if you're wondering what template to use, we have a free template quiz over on the website. I've linked that in the description below. So if you're on the fence about what template to use and you want to kind of crawl into my brain, do the old Feigenbaum algorithm, well, I put it in a handy dandy quiz, so you don't have to, you know, go through that medical procedure. Before we get into the podcast, Austin, have you been watching the Olympics?
Sure have. Mainly been paying attention to swimming and then seeing bits and pieces of some of the other sports going on. What about
Shocker.
You?
Shocker. Shocker. I watched some of the event. That's the horse stuff. And then okay. I've been watching some of the behind the scenes stuff for the golf. Big surprise. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing. So the Olympics are in Paris, right? Where are they holding the golf Olympic event?
That I don't know. I know there was like a surf event that they're doing in like Tahiti or somewhere like on the other side of the world from France. I didn't know that golf was being held someplace else entirely as well.
Yeah, it's in Italy. It's at the Marco Simone Golf Club. That's where they held the Ryder Cup last year, where the U.S. got demolished. Although if you watch the full swing thing, it made it seem a lot closer than it actually was. So we'll see. There's been some spicy interviews coming out. They asked Rory McIlroy about the length of the rough. You know, hey, is it about the same as the Ryder Cup? And he said, I don't know. You'll have to ask the Americans. I didn't spend much time there. So shots fired. Xander Schauffele.
Excellent response.
Yeah. Xander Schauffele is the defending champion from out of San Diego. So we'll see how Team USA does. And I've got the weightlifting stuff queued up as well. So I'll be waiting for some of the heavier weight classes to come up. So yeah, Olympics are going on, going strong here. I feel like there was something else I wanted to ask you, but I can't recall off the top of my head. So we'll just pretend that it was something awesome, and we'll just get into the podcast. All right, so let's move on to the mystery case. I'm going to tell you, I think this is the most challenging one yet.
Okay.
And so we're just going to see how your anatomy skills are.
Oh boy. All right.
Yep. Yeah,
I had I'm currently still working in the hospital, and my team was what we call post call today, meaning that yesterday's 24-hour period was our call period, where any patient who came into the ER who needed to be admitted to internal medicine came to my team. So we did the evaluation and brought them in. And so this morning, actually, I had a more than usual number of essentially mystery cases that I have not yet cracked, several of them, that their kind of evaluation is ongoing. So we spent quite a bit of time talking with these folks and evaluating them and talking about all the possibilities on rounds with my team and teaching my interns. So already did a bit of this earlier today. We'll see how much juice is left for this case.
There you go. Anybody with factor 8 overabundance?
Unfortunately, no. I have not yet seen that one come across.
Dude, this is what I was going to bring up. So one, I wanted to shout out to Claire Zai, one of our coaches. She's just started medical school. She had her white coat ceremony this past weekend. My brother has his white coat ceremony this weekend. That's like the start to medical school. So I was sitting next to Alex, another one of our coaches at Claire's white coat ceremony. And he said, hey, do you think you could pass step one, like right now? And I said, I don't know, but I think it would be close, mainly because I know the format of the test, like how they ask the questions. Mm-hmm. And then somewhere deep in my hippocampus is a lot of knowledge that I use to do, you know, decently well on step one. So then he whips out his phone and it's a flashcard, right? And it's like, what medical condition would this tinea coleum cause? And I was like, oh, neurocysticosis. Duh. And he goes, how do you know that? And I go, I told you, dude, it's in there.
It was like very heavily tested.
So. Yeah, you don't see it that much, as it turns out, from undercooked pork products, I suppose. But it was in there. So he
actually
he
depends
was,
on what part of the obviously what part of the world you're in for that particular condition. It is the most common cause of seizures worldwide. And actually, working in Texas near the border of Mexico and Central America, I've actually seen numerous cases of neurocysticercosis over the years and diagnosed them. So kind of some geography and epidemiology can impact that quite a bit.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I saw a ton of Chagas. So
there you go.
Yeah, we were a Chagas Center for Excellence at one of the UCLA sites that I rotated at. So, all right. Speaking of medicine, we're going to get into this week's mystery case. Now, if you're just joining us first time on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, we start out most of our recent podcasts with a mystery case. These are real medical cases. I present the information to Dr. Baraki in a piecemeal fashion, and he kind of lets us into his thought process, which can be useful for problem solving, especially when it comes to like health-related things, and it's good infotainment. But yes, this is a real case. Didn't just make this up. And I'll be curious. I think this is your most difficult challenge yet. So we'll see.
Let's see how far we can get.
Yeah, to be clear, I interface with you regularly. So I this is just par for the course. I'm like, oh, everybody's like Baraki, of course. He's just, he's a genius. Everybody else. It turns out not the case. Okay, to be clear. So I will give you the credit, but I think you and I hang out too much for me to be like...
You've been desensitized.
I have been desensitized. That's right. Yes. All right. Here we go. 24-year-old male presents to the emergency department for severe leg and hip pain on both sides that started while he was doing hill interval sprints. He reports the pain started in his right thigh, but then spread to his left thigh and then to both hips. His past medical history is significant for asthma, which he has a rescue inhaler, but he has not used it for over a year. On review of symptoms, he has had a one-day history of shortness of breath on exertion, along with dizziness. He denies any cough, fever, or chest pain. He doesn't take any medications, and he does not smoke or use recreational drugs. He also denies any trauma, and he's never had this before. Austin, any initial thoughts?
Okay, so that was a fair amount. Let me just summarize what I heard, that we have a 24-year-old kid with a history of asthma that I think you said was well-controlled. Is that right?
Yep.
And so he was exerting himself doing some hill sprints when he experienced essentially acute bilateral thigh and then hip pain.
Yep.
And that's in the context of also having some shortness of breath with exertion and some dizziness.
Yep.
Okay. So we have, similar to some previous ones, multiple kind of starting concerns. And the ones that are going to take the center of my focus is mainly going to be the leg and hip pain. Of course, I'm going to pay attention to shortness of breath anytime somebody has it. But if I were taking this patient's history, I'd try to get a sense of like, does this feel like what he's experienced before with asthma exacerbations or not? If it's like, oh, that's exactly like what my asthma usually feels like, then I might set that aside. If he's like, no, I've never felt this kind of shortness of breath before, then I might interrogate that a little bit more deeply. And then the dizziness, as we've talked about before, is not really seemingly the center of this presenting concern and is pretty nonspecific. So I'm just going to also set that one on the side for a moment. And so focusing on the bilateral leg and hip pain, as we've done before with other cases that involve leg pain, thinking about the kind of the compartments of the leg, the structures that can lead to some discomfort. We have the vascular aspect, which was usually the kind that we get the most concerned about in the acute, you know, short-term period. So, you know, the aorta branches out into various, you know, aortic branches that go down to supply blood to the leg, and then the veins bring blood back from the leg, you know, to the heart. And so you can have issues with any of these vessels. They can become inflamed, they can become occluded, they can dissect, there can be clots, there can be compression, there can be various things affecting these blood vessels. There's the muscles themselves that can become injured, for example, just through exertional rhabdomyolysis, which we've had a case of before. They can get ischemic, lack of blood flow, an infarct, they can get infected, they can tear, you can bleed into your, you know, your thighs. There's various complications that can happen in that compartment, leading to things like compartment syndrome that we've talked about before. Then there's the neurological aspect, the nerves that emerge from the spinal cord and go down to supply the legs. And so that is a bit less, I feel like a bit less likely based on the description that we have here so far, but that has a usually a bit more of a characteristic type of pain. It can be associated with sensory loss, it can be associated with weakness in terms of like an acute neuropathy or something like that. And then the bones and joints and associated ligaments and structures and things like that, which that type of an issue is most often traumatic. But if there's some kind of a vulnerability in the patient's bones for some reason, then they might predispose to fracture. It's just unlikely that this, you know, this would be a very unfortunate 24-year-old if they were to experience, you know, acute bilateral fractures in their in their legs just from exertion. I would have a lot more questions if we identified something like that. So those are kind of like the big categories of things that I'm thinking about with legs and hips and thighs. There are, of course, many other things that, you know, if they become relevant with some more information, then I can, you know, open up that those boxes of things like infections and autoimmune conditions and various other things. It's just that the acuity, the speed with which this onset has also kind of gotten my attention. Firstly, in terms of, you know, a lot of times the quicker some sort of a syndrome onsets, oftentimes the quicker you need to move to rule out the worst possible things that can happen that quickly. And most of the time that's something vascular, are some of the more emergency type things to rule out in these situations. So that's the way I'm starting to think about the legs and hips here. And then, as I said, I would just want to ask a bit more questions about his shortness of breath. I won't get into the entire, you know, approach to shortness of breath right now, but if that becomes relevant, I can certainly do that. Just really wanting to know, does this feel like your asthma or does this not feel like your asthma? And then sure, that can kind of guide some of my subsequent questioning.
Yeah, before we move on, actually, I thought one maybe interesting thing would be, you know, this guy shows up to the emergency department with leg pain, right? Bilateral leg, lower extremity pain, so the hips and the thighs, which are certainly things that you and I have both experienced, you know, whether it's one-sided, but we've also experienced on both sides before. Yet it was so intense and so abrupt that he felt compelled to go to the emergency room. Now, obviously, that threshold is kind of a personal threshold, like varies significantly about, you know, what you're going to do about it and how concerned you are. But what, for you personally, you know, what like level of pain or abruptness of pain or like pain out of proportion to what you were doing would sort of trigger you to be like, I probably need to get evaluated
totally
immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it would be mainly an aspect of kind of proportionality would be the one thing that I would think about. And then the other would be whether there are any other associated symptoms mm-hmm. that lead me to be more concerned. So some examples of that in terms of proportionality is like, does it make sense that it hurts this bad and in this location based on whatever I was doing or the mechanism of injury? If there was, say, a trauma to the area and then it hurts real bad right where I got hit, sure, that makes sense. If I was, you know, doing a particular activity under a great deal of strain or load or fatigue and, you know, felt a pop in a muscle belly or something like that, I'm like, okay, buy that. But if it was a relatively minor, you know, level of exertion or activity and I get like severe disproportionate pain, or if there was no trauma at all and it was kind of more spontaneous, those are things that would get my attention. And then when I mentioned like associated signs or symptoms, for example, if I had like this acute pain and I had weakness in my leg, or like, you know, sudden sensory loss in my leg, or discoloration of my like pretty significant discoloration to what the point where, you know, it was turning super white or it was turning super purple and plethoric and things like that, that might lead me to think about something more than just like a muscle strain or, you know, something like that. So proportionality, yeah, and then the associated symptoms are what would guide my moves there.
Yeah, that's helpful for sure. All right. So in the emergency department, his vital signs, he was afebrile, so no fever. He was tachycardic to 103 beats per minute. His respiratory rate was 20. He's sitting 100% on room air. And his blood pressure was 126 over 69. His physical exam was remarkable for a swollen right calf, and his left calf was tender to palpation. Otherwise, his lower extremity exam was pretty normal. He had normal pulses bilaterally. Capillary refill was normal bilaterally. Strength, tactile sense, and reflexes in both lower extremities were normal. The rest of his exam was unremarkable. Heart sounds were normal. Chest was clear. No lymphadenopathy. He had an EKG, showed a normal sinus rhythm. Had a chest x-ray done that showed an azygous fissure, okay, which is an anatomic variant of the right upper lobe of the lung, if you were unfamiliar with that terminology. It's formed by a laterally displaced azygous vein, which makes a deep pleural fissure into the right upper lung lobe of the lung's apical segment during embryogenesis. Shout out to our embryology class for that knowledge. He had an ultrasound of his left leg that revealed a thrombus extending from the left common femoral vein to the popliteal vein. And his right leg, with an ultrasound on that as well, showed a thrombus in his great saphenous vein. Bedside echocardiogram was normal, and his troponin in the ED was 2. So before we go any further, any thoughts? I know I threw a lot at you there, but feel like you're probably on the right track here, which is encouraging.
Sure. So summarizing what I heard, his vitals are pretty much fine. Nothing that's shockingly unexpected or terribly concerning here. He had swollen calves in which we found a thrombus or a clot in both of his calves. But the rest of his kind of vascular exam is okay. The EKG is reassuring, and the chest x-ray, that finding seems like a normal anatomic variant that I'm not likely to put a ton of effort into, at least right now when I have a more acute problem much further away from that kind of territory down in the legs. So we have venous clots in both legs that seem to have developed pretty acutely. The other question I had, this troponin of 2, I mean, I don't have units on that. We're getting a little bit into the weeds, but I mentioned this last time that there are like kind of different scales. If this is one of the older troponin lab tests, then this would be actually a pretty elevated troponin measurement. If it's one of the newer ones, it would be like trivially, like, you know, not even significant at all. So without knowing that detail, I don't know if you're able to tell me.
Yes. So they actually don't have units in here. However, based on what I know the case to be, it would be trivially elevated, okay, and so not probably on your radar.
Cool. All right. So I'm not going to spend a ton of time thinking about that. So basically now we're solving a case of a 24-year-old who, in the setting of exertion, seemingly developed acute bilateral deep venous thrombi, pretty extensive deep venous thrombi, or blood clots in the deep veins of both of his legs, which I will admit is a relatively uncommon type of presentation. And so that brings up the question of, like, why do people clot? What are the ways that that sort of process happens? Typically, clotting is initiated by some sort of tissue injury in most situations. That tissue injury, when you combine that with some platelets and some other kind of chemical mediators and then a bunch of clotting factors, then those all kind of come together and generate a stabilized kind of fibrin clot. And so the other factors that can contribute to blood clotting tendencies are if there are underlying conditions that increase the tendency of clotting, like our last case that we did, or if somebody has an underlying cancer or certain genetic conditions that can increase the predisposition to clotting. Another factor that can increase that risk involves compression of blood vessels that leads the blood to kind of sit around longer than it otherwise would. So there are conditions that can lead to people to have recurrent blood clots over time because a vessel is compressed. For example, something called May-Thurner syndrome. This compression of vessels leads blood to kind of be a little bit more stagnant. And when blood sits around, it tends to clot. And so I'm mostly curious if this patient has ever had any clots before himself, if there's any family history of clots in the past, if he has any known, you know, it doesn't sound like he has any known hematologic or blood disorders. We may be on a path to start evaluating some of those similar to the last case we did in terms of what we call hypercoagulable conditions. And then finally, an evaluation of his actual vasculature beyond just the area where the blood clot is may be actually in order. In other words, looking a little bit higher up at the blood vessels and seeing if there's any kind of anatomic abnormalities that might predispose him to develop clots.
Yeah, no, good thinking. So there was a hypercoagulability workup performed. So things like his ANA, an antiphospholipid antibody, anticardiolipin lipin levels, HIV, JAK2 mutation, all that stuff was negative. completely negative workup. He had a CT pulmonary angiogram, which is a medical diagnostic test that uses computed tomography and angiography, just basically take pictures of the pulmonary arteries along with the vasculature, other vasculature in the thorax, and it showed extensive bilateral pulmonary emboli. There was no saddle embolus, however. Also had a CT abdomen and pelvis, effectively showed that his femoral and internal iliac veins were prominent, and there were clots seen in both iliac veins and the distal IVC. However, no inferior vena cava, that's the IVC, was visible above the renal veins, and the proximal IVC was visible and patent, with lots of venous collateralization in the retroperitoneum. The abdominal venous drainage was predominantly via the azygos and hemiazygos system. So for your anatomy nerds out there, effectively these are collaterals for ways you can drain venous blood out of the area if there's something going on perhaps in the inferior vena cava. So with that information now, do you have any thoughts slash potential diagnosis?
Yeah, this is getting a bit complex, and the details of those imaging reads would be very handy to be able to read instead of try to remember all of the things that you said. But my understanding, it sounds like he had multiple clots that made it all the way into his lungs. And so those presumably are what we call emboli, meaning they have traveled from someplace else and landed in that territory. And so that finding is more a consequence of the other stuff that's going on rather than the primary cause. So even though that's the thing that's most likely to kill him in the short term and would be getting treated most urgently, from a diagnostic standpoint, I'm like setting that aside right now. He'd be getting treated with blood thinners to deal with that and potentially other interventions if needed. However, we also seem to have found, kind of like what I was alluding to, some sort of anatomic, you know, abnormality in the abdominal in the abdominal cavity that is leading the drainage of blood from his leg veins that comes all the way up and come together to get effectively shunted in a different direction than it would normally take to make its way all the way back to the right heart. We have prominent iliac veins. That's probably essentially like, you know, if you think of it like he has little varicose veins because of back pressure, because of some sort of an occlusion, obstruction, stenosis, something like that going on in the normal kind of IVC territory. If I had to guess, or the, you know, I would be reviewing these images myself. I'd be looking at the read very carefully to see what is the level of obstruction that this could potentially be at. We have the inferior vena cava, we have the hepatic veins, we have, you know, other things in the abdomen that can either be compressed, that can lead to blood getting shunted in a different direction. So that could be external compression of a vessel, or there could be something wrong with the vessel itself, such that the vessel can have what's called stenosis. Or, you know, in a patient who's this young, I'd be wondering, hey, is it possible that he had some sort of a congenital vascular abnormality that led to, like, you know, some sort of involution of this vessel, agenesis of this vessel, something that led it to not develop normally in the first place? And then blood finds a way in the body, right? So almost anywhere in most territories, if there's an issue with normal path of blood flow, the body has ways of doing what's called angiogenesis and shunting blood around, you know, effectively, if the highway is blocked, finding like a, you know, a surface street.
Yeah,
exactly. It finds a different way to get back to where it needs to go. And I've seen CT scans of patients who've had some kind of vascular occlusion, and their collateral blood flow that makes its way back to his heart, it's like incredible, all the different paths, the new blood vessels that sprout to get blood back to where it's trying to go. So what I'd be doing in this situation is, again, scanning through the slices of that CT scan very closely to try to see, is there some, what's the cause of this blood flow getting shunted in a different direction to go and drain through the azygos system instead of through the cable system, which is what we would normally have going on. And if the normal CT scan that he had done was insufficient for this, then you may need to actually do a dedicated, like, you know, venogram type scan to look for evidence of external compression or stenosis or occlusion or agenesis or whatever kind of thing possibly. Yeah.
So just to review some of the anatomy of the that was shown on the CT scan, basically the hepatic section, so the liver section of his IVC was normal. And then the IVC below the kidneys, so at the level, the renal level and the infrarenal level, were also normal. However, no suprarenal IVC was seen. So if you were forced, gun to head, to put your money on a diagnosis for this patient based on his presentation and these findings, do you have a final answer before we get into what this guy was diagnosed with and his course?
Yeah, I suppose I'm most concerned for some sort of congenital agenesis sort of thing, or some sort of congenital anomaly leading him to not develop a linked IVC, and then gradually over time led to this collateralization, ultimately decompensated in terms of like venous hypertension, stasis, leading to the blood clots.
Yeah, no, it's really good. And I suspect that more testing was actually done in this particular case for them to arrive at this answer because of the presented information doesn't quite put a bow on it. So I assume some more stuff was gone on, but they were ultimately limited by word count. But yeah, they chalk this up to an absent or hypoplastic, so just, you know, the formation of this suprarenal, so above the kidney, inferior vena cava, there was something abnormal there. So it was either absent due to a congenital abnormality, or it involuted early on, or there was some pathology early on in life that led to DVTs, probably due to venous stasis, and pulmonary embolisms due to clot formation in the collateral veins traveling through the heart and lungs. Now, the inferior vena cava is the largest vein in the body, carries deoxygenated blood from the lower body back to the right heart, the right heart's right atrium. And there are four parts to the inferior vena cava. There's one near the liver. It's called the hepatic section. Suprarenal, that's above the renal arteries and veins, so above the kidneys. There's one at the level of the kidneys. That's called the renal section of the IVC. And there's one below it called the infrarenal. Now, in this patient, the suprarenal portion either did not form correctly or had some issue later on in life. And the azygous fissure, which is why I kind of commented so heavily on this, is a tip off that something didn't form right. It's actually an anatomical variant in about 1% of people. And it forms during embryological development when the posterior cardinal vein, which is a precursor to the upper thoracic segment of the azygous vein, erroneously migrates through the upper lobe of the lung. That's a bunch of anatomy nerd speak for like the maybe, you know, where this whole thing came from, but it's effectively related to inferior vena cava formation below the liver. So this guy had a pulmonary embolisms, had DVTs. He was treated with the tinzaparin initially, but it switched to Eliquis or apixaban for lifelong therapy. He was discharged on that. He recovered well, discharged home after a few days. They had considered a mechanical,
thrombectomy.
But ultimately decided against it because he was pretty stable. Yeah. And he was asymptomatic at 1 year, returned to exercise, returned to sport, was able to do fine.
Sounds to me like I got it. That's pretty cool, man.
Yeah, impressive. Impressive. I was curious mostly on the anatomy stuff. I mean, I think if you saw the images as I did, I go, well, why is there no inferior vena cava there? That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could talk yourself out of it if you wanted to. You were like, well, maybe I'm not visualizing this. Maybe it's, you know, smaller than normal, whatever. But I think the pearl here, you know, one we talked about was like just levels of musculoskeletal pain and like what causes concern. But the other one I wanted you to comment on was maybe the difference between like musculoskeletal pain and like a concern for a DVT like this. You know, it's pretty unlikely, like you said, in younger patients, especially bilaterally, unless, you know, you can imagine there's been case reports of people using knee wraps, for example, and that happening, or other sort of occlusive things. But if you were going to give the listeners at home a sort of clinical pearl to take home, like when is this just run of the mill, like muscle strain, whatever, versus, you know, a DVT or concern for DVT? Do you think you chalk that up mostly to associated symptoms like, oh, your calf is painful and swollen, or it's red, or, you know, something like that, or other symptoms, maybe like neurological type stuff or weakness or something like that?
Oof, this is a lot harder question than it would initially seem. There's a lot of times where, you know, we might experience, either you or I might experience some ache or pain in the context of training, and we're kind of like grateful for our medical training and experience because it allows us to self-assess and triage like reasonably well. But I can't reasonably expect everyone to be able to do that. And it's like, I can't transfer all of this knowledge to, you know, a layperson who's in training to help them make the correct decision that a physician would if they were assessing them, right? Outside of just, you know, doing these cases and maybe giving people some peripheral knowledge, although I still would not advise that people use any of this as medical advice, et cetera, all the standard disclaimers would apply, right? But if, again, the discomfort that somebody's experiencing is disproportionate in some way, if it's like, wow, I have these sore calves after I've, you know, never trained in my life, and suddenly I went on like a calf training program and I did like 50 sets of calf raises. It's like, well, I kind of expect that. That's, you know, reasonable to expect. If it's disproportionate, if it's unexpected, is one kind of consideration. None of these are going to be perfect rules that tell you it's a clot or it's not. Rather, it's just probabilities. It's going to weigh you in a different direction, one or the other, right? If the discomfort kind of disappears, if you're not exerting yourself, but if you go to like, you know, plantar flex, squeeze your calf muscle a little bit and it hurts a little more, maybe that biases me a little bit more towards a muscular type of issue, soreness. Whereas if it's uncomfortable and if there's like swelling and it's tight and that's progressive, you know, those are all things that might make me actually more concerned about a vascular problem like an occlusion. Now, some of you might think, gosh, like I felt, you know, some tightness, some swelling, and I just call that the pump. And it's like, yeah, well, sometimes it is just the pump, but I can't actually confidently tell you every time that it is or it isn't. without, for, you know, actually taking a look. It's very, you know, fast, easy, cheap to put an ultrasound probe on a vein and see if it compresses or not, to see if there's a clot there. So I think that that concept of proportionality, the associated symptoms, if there's significant discoloration, if it's progressive, if it's not resolving in the expected time course that you would expect for just run-of-the-mill muscle soreness, those are all some things that I would think about that might weigh me to towards a little bit more of a concerning etiology. And if, again, if you're concerned, just go get checked out. Like, that's the way to answer the question, rather than to try to, like, do this cognitive, you know, clinical reasoning exercise when you don't have any clinical training.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's tough to ask people to kind of be their own physician here. And that's not what we mean by self-efficacy. But that extends all the way down to, you know, everything from medical testing, like laboratory stuff, you know, even to, like, the acute setting. So, yeah, it can be difficult. I just think that if you're concerned, that's a great probably pearl. If you are concerned, it's probably best to get it checked out. And I know that's vague, but it's intentionally vague because, yeah, it's probably the thing you can, you know, go with your gut. On that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Last thing I'd like to add is anatomy is cool. That's the other pearl here. If you had a really strong anatomy background, maybe if you're a member of the, you know, American Association for Anatomists, for example, the coolest club there is out there as a card carrying member, you know, you probably would have been able to figure this out when, as soon as somebody said azygous fissure, and you're like, interesting. I wonder the embryological sort of sequelae to that, and you might have gotten here. So a pretty interesting case, I thought. And I actually, the last thing I'll say, I think with his one day history of like dyspnea or shortness of breath on exertion, to me, it's probably likely that not only did the pulmonary emboli and the thrombi bilaterally probably form prior to this, maybe not as big, but he most likely became aware of them on exertion at this level of intensity. Does that sound about right to you?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, I see this all the time where, you know, people who are in very good physical shape, they actually tend to notice these sorts of things more so when it limits them from performing at the level that they're usually expected to be able to perform at. Whereas if I have a you know, an older adult who has a lot of, you know, usual kind of medical diseases and is very sedentary, by the time they finally notice shortness of breath or chest pain, for example, from heart disease, given that they never actually exert themselves, it's often pretty advanced. Whereas somebody who is very fit and active, they might notice it much earlier on in the course, which is yet another reason to be super active, because it can help you be more sensitive to detect issues if they were to emerge.
Yeah, agreed. Also, if you're if you're interested in anatomy, but you're not quite willing to sign up for an anatomy course or something, I don't have like a turnkey anatomy resource for you. However, if there was one, it would be Moore's Clinical Anatomy. To me, that is the best anatomical text for learning anatomy in a like informal way, mainly because there's actually text associated with all of the anatomical plates, the images, whereas a thing like Netter, for example, people recommend Netter all the time to medical students and you know, other health professionals going through it, their education. It's just pictures. And it's like, if you don't have any text accompanying that, you're not really sure what you're looking at or why it's clinically relevant. So that's a great text. And the University of Michigan's anatomy website has a ton of free resources for like clinically relevant anatomy. So if you're curious about this and you want to kind of learn as you go, imagine if there was like a Babbel or something for anatomy. I think that would be pretty cool. But
you can commission that app. I mean, this might end up being one of the bigger sources of disagreement between us, that physiology is way cooler than anatomy.
Oh, okay. But to it, I don't actually disagree with that. I like, for me, you know, if we had an origin story of me like going into medicine or being interested, it was certainly physiology. I was like, this is so cool. But I also think it's difficult to kind of conceptualize the physiology in many situations without anatomy as well. So, which is why
A&P
is usually, yeah, exactly. Peanut butter and jelly. Okay. Well, let's move on to my favorite segment of our most recent podcast, Quack Watch. All right. So Austin, I'm going to let you listen to this link and then we'll play that audio for you guys and then we'll weigh in on it.
I have all these women patients who come to me with non-existent cholesterol. And I'm like, well, I don't know. Where are we going with this? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and so I think that too has a huge part. We don't talk about that, but obviously, you know, you're going to have problems with pretty much all your hormones if you have no cholesterol.
All right. Now, the caption here says, patients often come to me with dangerously low cholesterol levels after being on statins. Over the years, statins have become overprescribed, While statins are beneficial in some cases, we forget that cholesterol is made endogenously in the human body by the liver. Why would we make it if we don't need it? Many hormones, such as testosterone and estrogen, have cholesterol in their chemical structures. This whole thing implies that if your cholesterol is, quote, too low, that you're going to have endocrine-related problems in addition to overall worse health because of that. Any hot take right off the jump?
Yeah, I am relatively dismissive of this claim, but for several reasons. I think that, you know, we've talked about just the overall body of evidence around blood cholesterol and blood lipids, both as it relates to risk of disease like cardiovascular disease and various others. In this case, concerns about hormone-related production. And so when I listen to that claim, it's very much focused on just a line of, you know, quote-unquote logic or reasoning that, as I've said before with these quack watches, sounds good if you don't really know much about the topic. And so if you agree that cholesterol is used to make hormones, which, yes, check,
yep,
that is
check.
Correct.
Yep, that's true, yeah.
Then it would seem to make sense that in order to make hormones, you need a whole bunch of cholesterol supply, which, like, okay, maybe.
Yep. Sure.
And then finally, therefore, you need a lot of it circulating around in your blood. And that's the step of, that's like the leap that is being made here that, again, sounds good, but is not necessarily correct. And part of the reason is that she's making the claim that it's only made in the liver. And in other words, if it's only made in the liver and it's not making it into your blood, then how could it actually get used in your organs? And the vast majority of pretty much every cell in our body can make all of the cholesterol that it needs. There are some cells that actually get cholesterol delivered to them, relatively uncommon. The gonads, for example, get some share of some cholesterol delivery actually via HDL particles to some extent. But the fact that all the cells in our body make the cholesterol that they need kind of serves in some way to refute the line of reasoning that is being proposed here. However, more importantly than any of this is actual evidence of this happening. And so fortunately, this is one of the most well-studied kind of interventions and areas, because cardiovascular disease is such a huge issue worldwide, that interventions to lower blood cholesterol levels are very, 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 very heavily studied. And so we should see in those data sets, the consequences, the side effects, the risks that are being claimed. Now, I truly do not care if the evidence comes to show, say, that statins are more toxic than they are beneficial and we should never prescribe them. If the evidence showed that, I'm happy to stop prescribing them. There are a lot of medicines that I was taught about in school or that I used in training that I no longer use for various reasons. I'm not like, you know, emotionally attached or wedded to the use of statins here. If the evidence were to show that they have all of these effects, cool, I'll move on to something that has a better, you know, risk-benefit profile. But just the sheer volume of data that we have on this in terms of lowering people's blood lipids down to like an LDL cholesterol level of like 20 or less. And if this was a major problem, given the scale of these studies and the breadth of them, we should see rampant new onset hypogonadism. We should see rampant new onset, you know, all sorts of endocrine disorders. And that signal just does not emerge in these studies. And the only, you know, retort that I might expect from somebody making those claims is like, well, yeah, you know, that's because the studies are from Big Pharma or something like that, which, first of all, they're not all, you know, funded in that way. Many of these drugs are generic now, but also the sheer amount of conspiracy related coordination to fraudulently direct all of these studies specifically to hide a signal for hypogonadism on the order of hundreds of thousands of patients and all these, it's like, why would anyone do that? So it's just not correct on a biological level and doesn't really emerge in the evidence, which I'm very open to, but it just has not been shown. So that's my thought.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can get some associations here, like individuals with chronic illnesses in particular will have like low cholesterol and then also like low circulating levels of testosterone. We know that to be true. But to me, that's more of a reflection of health rather than causal. And again, it's been pretty well established. And in fact, when you kind of look at correlations between various lipid levels or lipid parameters and endocrine function, you see a positive relationship between things like HDL and testosterone, for example. So HDL, again, being high density lipoprotein, and you could call that a marker of good health, although we don't think that is predictive of heart disease per se. But in general, folks who are relatively healthy have higher levels of HDL. They also have higher levels of testosterone. On the other hand, total testosterone levels and free testosterone levels are inversely related to triglycerides. And if you had a bunch of cholesterol floating around in your body, in your bloodstream, well, you'd have higher levels of triglycerides. And wouldn't that be expected to raise testosterone levels, but doesn't seem to be found. In fact, there are a number of data sets actually investigating this directly. So for example, a cross-sectional study enrolling just under 2,000 men aged 20 to 80 basically looked at the relationship between cholesterol intake, cholesterol levels in the blood, and total testosterone levels. Neither dietary cholesterol intake nor total cholesterol levels in the blood were associated with testosterone levels in men in the United States. Another study done in an Asian population showed an inverse relationship between total blood cholesterol and triglyceride level and total testosterone, whereas, again, there was still a positive relationship between HDL and total testosterone. And in women, this was also investigated where they looked at estrogen levels and progesterone levels. So this was just under 500 women. Some of them were premenopausal, some of them were perimenopausal, some of them were postmenopausal, and they all had heart disease risk factors, so they were all on statins, right? Specifically what this woman was talking about. Now, mean estrogen level did not correlate with LDL. So that means those with the lowest levels of low density lipoprotein cholesterol, well, that didn't predict their estrogen level at all. And neither did the use of statins. It was not associated with estrogen or progesterone differences at all. So in my view, it's not necessarily that cholesterol influences testosterone or testosterone influences cholesterol, outside of them both being reflective of kind of health status, if that kind of makes sense. You'd in general predict that people with higher levels of baseline health to have higher levels of testosterone and more favorable levels of certain cholesterol sort of metrics on a standard lipid panel. So I don't think that they're actually causal per se, outside of more reflective of other things that are going on. Or in some cases like anabolic steroid use, you have people who start using high levels of testosterone, and that can certainly cause lipid abnormalities. You can also see people with hypogonadism, and you can see lipid abnormalities in them, and that may be related, again, to this underlying health condition that caused the hypogonadism in the first place, or other sort of abnormalities as a result of the hypogonadism. But overall, when I listen to this, now she's a board-certified internal medicine physician and obesity medicine certified board certification as well. And so you would think, well, she's probably got to be an expert, have some expertise on this. So it's like, what are you talking about, lady? And that's kind of where I'll leave it.
Yeah, I think we've beaten this to death.
Fair enough. All right. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. Now, I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert, so you can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. I wanted to take a second to talk about our new podcast sponsor, Mint Mobile. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again, because when they say $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, they mean it. There's no surprise monthly bills and unexpected overages. They have premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month, and all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/BBM. That's mintmobile.com/BBM. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/BBM. $45 upfront payment required. That's equivalent to $15 a month. And this is limited to new customers on a first 3 month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigabytes on the unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Well, let's move on to the next section of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. This is episode 302 with Dr. Austin Baracchi. I'm going to enter the research review portion of the podcast. So the first paper we're going to discuss is titled Placebo and Nocebo Effects on Sports and Exercise Performance, a Systematic Literature Review Update. This is by Shabra and Szabo. This is a research group out of Hungary. It was published in the June 2024 edition of the journal Nutrients. So as a background here, placebo is an inactive or inert intervention that is not expected to have a systemic effect, yet it, quote, works to improve performance or other health outcomes via an individual's expectation or previous experience. Now, this can vary wildly based on an individual, between individuals, because there's a large learning component, which itself depends on conditioning, situational factors, environment, and so on. In this view, a placebo effect is a favorable outcome resulting from a belief, where the belief activates various mechanisms within the brain to generate an outcome. Nocebo is kind of on the other side, the opposite to this, is also an inactive agent, event, or idea that is not expected to have an effect, yet it, quote, works to reduce or hinder performance or health outcomes via an individual's expectation or their previous experiences. Again, it varies by person. And in this view, a nocebo effect is a poor outcome resulting from a negative belief. Now, in sport, placebo and nocebo effects have been well established. For example, one study showed a nearly 24% increase in leg strength measured via leg extension secondary to a caffeine placebo. People were just taking a placebo caffeine pill. They thought it was caffeine, and they were like, boom, I'm stronger. Another study showed that people ran slower after receiving a nocebo that the subjects were led to believe reduced running velocity. So a lot of this has to do with expectations and learning and such. You can't really separate the two. So this study looked at 20 papers of intervention studies on performance where each intervention was either a placebo or nocebo. And if you read the study, I've linked the whole study in the description below. They basically universally refer to these things as placebo until the effect is sort of generated, right? Sure. So it's just an inert sort of thing that people get. And if it's positive, you call it a placebo. And if it's negative, it's called a nocebo. The subjects in the studies, they range from healthy, untrained individuals all the way to elite kayakers, for example. There was some strength training stuff in there as well. And some were active ingredients like actual caffeine versus placebo caffeine, and others were just straight up placebo. In some cases, they informed the folks of what they were getting. Other times, they didn't know. So the results, I'll review a few of the specific agents that they tested, and then we can kind of wrap this up with a little summary. The first one was caffeine. Now, caffeine itself did outperform placebo caffeine, but placebo caffeine also improved performance in most studies if people were led to believe there was caffeine. It was a moderate effect size, so pretty substantial actual improvement, mostly in running type activities, but some of the strength data was actually kind of mixed. And so to me, this not only suggests a obvious potential placebo effect if people think that they're taking caffeine, for example, but also if they're taking anything, almost as long as they have not been like negatively led to believe it's going to cause them harm. But the activity probably matters as far as the effect size, right? So for like 1RM performance, I don't know that I'd expect a huge benefit, but maybe for endurance-related performance based on the existing data. Another sort of group of interventions that they looked at was like a Tic Tac administration prior to exercise, which I found hilarious. So two studies showed improved kayak sprint performance with a Tic Tac being given, as the subjects were effectively conditioned to believe that there was an ingredient within Tic Tacs that was performance enhancing. That's so it's awesome. Like, they call this placebo doping, and yeah. I'm like, I'm here for it. Hey, it's the Olympics. Let's talk about doping.
I mean, all of us, I think our generation first learned about this from watching Space Jam as a kid, when he gave them a bottle of Mike's secret stuff, and then they went out and they beat the Monstars. You know, that was their introduction to placebo.
I think that speaks to depending on your age group and depending on what kind of movies you were raised on, because I immediately thought to Days of Thunder with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. And, you know, when they say, hey, you got a set of matched tires, if you go to the outside, you can't hold. And he wins the race, and he's like, yeah, thanks for those matched tires, Harry. He's like, what matched tires? And they got into a fight. So it depends on the different era, what you were raised on. But yeah, absolutely. There were some other studies where they used menthol, and again, were leading the subjects to believe that this was a performance-enhancing agent, and there was no improvement in running. So not a slam dunk, but it is kind of interesting that you can find these effects. Another group that they kind of looked at was this, they called it the pink drink, and it was an artificially sweetened pink drink, and effectively the performance improvement was proportional to how sweet the people rated the drink, because the authors of these particular studies thought that, well, the sweeter that people perceived it, they likely believed there was more carbohydrates in the drink, even though there were no carbohydrates in the drink at all. So
it's kind of anything. Placebos really, it just has to do with the perception of potency, which can come from a lot of different variables, you know, things that involve more intense sensory experiences, as this one, you know, seems to illustrate. Other ones, if somebody perceives the intervention to be like super new, cutting edge, high tech, if it's like, you know, favored by, you know, people that they admire, all sorts of things that can kind of augment that perception of potency, is what you would expect to augment the potential placebo type effect that it generates.
Yeah, Dr. Derek Miles of our pain and rehab team has talked about like the different colored kinesio tape, for example, or rock tape for a specific brand. He's like, well, if it's nude colored, it obviously can't work. But if it's pink and sparkly, it has a higher probability of working. Yeah. And there may be actually something to that. This one I thought was the most interesting. They use hyperoxic air. So this is oxygen enriched air. And they put the participants of the study through three separate trials. The first two, they were told they were being exposed to hyperoxic air. And then they were deceived on the third trial, where they were thought to be inspiring like normal air, but it was still the hyperoxic air. And they actually still, their performance was still higher with that, because it was like a conditioned response, which is interesting, again, when you think about the sort of learned sort of response based on the placebo effect. The last one we'll discuss specifically has to do with words and phrasing. So they basically were doing some isometric testing of shoulder strength. And these individuals were given these verbal cues that were either supposed to be positive or negative. So if they were negative, the researchers were asking about pain, paralysis, you know, accidents, illnesses, nausea, and stuff like that. So like, let us know when you feel pain. And then for the positive sort of cues, they were being supportive, healing, the health of the by testing this, you're improving your health, confidence, things of that nature. And so negative suggestions resulted in a significant decline in muscular performance, which ranges between 7% to 9% compared to baseline. However, when the benefits of the testing were highlighted, the decrease in muscle strength was mitigated. So people basically needed reassurance, which speaks to a lot of clinical situations you've likely been in.
Yeah, I mean, that is precisely the reason why we put a lot of emphasis on the way that we discuss problems or diagnosis or prognosis or management, or even in the context of coaching, the way that we phrase things, the words that we use, the things that we choose to focus on or draw attention to versus the things that we either don't draw attention to or deliberately draw attention away from, right? So de-threatening activity, making it not be so associated with pain. If somebody is dealing with pain and we're working through them from a rehab standpoint and coaching, not asking them about how their back feels after every single rep of their set, and then just framing things in a more optimistic, positive way, celebrating wins no matter how small, you know, high-fiving the the client after the tiniest thing goes well, instead of trying to focus on the things that aren't or that are uncomfortable or negative or unpleasant. All of that serves to set you up for more success than the other.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So overall, the placebo effects were reported in 13 out of 20 studies, and nocebo effects were reported in 3 studies. And these were twice as large as far as the size of the effect compared to the placebo effects. So it seems like the ability to maybe negatively influence somebody is maybe a little more potent than like kind of positively dupe them or like placebo doping. But yeah, I thought this was pretty interesting overall. And I think, you know, you gave a nice little summary that, you know, you want to be careful with the language that you're using, especially when it comes to like hypervigilance around an injury. So always asking about either recent injury or pain sensitivity or something like that. Framing things positively and offering support, that can be useful. Hyping up the benefits of a particular placebo can be useful. Maybe that's some placebo doping, which I think doping probably has a negative connotation. So we need like what would be a positive way to frame doping? Just like
just placebo enhancement, I guess.
Placebo enhancement. There you go. Yeah. Are you on a placebo enhancement drug? And finally, like a lot of things work for no quote real reason, although then we'd have to devolve into like this philosophical discussion of what real actually means. But I think when people think about placebo, they're like, all right, there's no like physiological basis for this to work. And I'm like, well, I don't know that you can separate the mind from the body. I think that's an even more philosophical question. So like either something works reliably or it doesn't. And when you're trying to identify the mechanism by which it works, I would say that for pretty much all interventions, there's some sort of placebo-mediated effect within, you know, the total effect. Now, for some like antibiotics, you'd expect placebo-mediated effect to be relatively low for an infection. But, you know, things like surgery, there's got to be some sort of, you know, a placebo-mediated effect there that's a considerably larger, and everything in between. Yeah, I don't know. Is that kind of your understanding of the placebo effect and kind of how it applies more broadly?
Yeah, I think it mainly, you know, what you're getting to there is as it relates to subjective symptom outcomes, then almost anything that you do to intervene is likely to have at least a component of placebo. Even things that do have an established biological mechanism or pharmacologic mechanism, they're going to have some component of placebo as far as insofar as the target is a subjective outcome, be it symptoms of nausea or pain or fatigue or sleep or you know, anything like that. When the outcome is not so subjective, like to your point when you mentioned antibiotics, like say somebody has Staph aureus in their blood, not going to be any real placebo effect on the clearance of Staph aureus out of your blood, because that's not really that type of an outcome that would be amenable to that sort of thing. And so it really has to do with what outcome we're looking at.
Yeah, although there has been some evidence of like various objective outcomes being mediated by like people being told certain things, like, oh, you have a gluten sensitivity, for example, then they eat a meal that they believe to have gluten in it and their, you know, transglutaminase antibodies go up some percent, which is humans are complex, not like cars really at all. And we do weird stuff. The last thing I'll say about this so we can move on is that mileage may vary. Like just like we see in training in response to supplements, there are responders, non-responders, hyper-responders, you know, all sorts of stuff. And so this is not to say that everybody is going to have a substantial placebo or nocebo effect. Again, there's a wide variation between individuals. Anything else you want to add to that, Austin?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting data on that. There's, you know, variation in genetic susceptibility to placebo type responses. There's a lot that could be discussed in this topic. For anyone who's interested, I'd refer them to a book by the king of placebo research, an Italian guy who I've cited before here. His name is Fabrizio Benedetti. He wrote a book titled Placebo Effects and would recommend if anybody has an interest in this topic. It's super interesting.
Yeah, excellent. All right, second and final study on episode 302 of July 2024 research review with Dr. Austin Baracchi. This paper is titled Long-Term Resistance-Trained Human Muscles Have More Fibers, More Myofibrils, and Tighter Myofilament Packing Than Untrained. Again, they didn't really leave anything to the imagination when they titled this paper.
Guess we're done here.
guess we're done. So some background here. First, this is mostly to do with muscular hypertrophy, which is defined in most studies as an increase in total mass of a muscle, whereas a decrease in total mass of a muscle is called atrophy. Now, each muscle is made up of thousands to hundreds of thousands or more muscle fibers. And in general, it is thought that the number of muscle fibers in humans is more or less fixed by the first year of life. There's some active debate around the idea that humans can increase the number of muscle fibers that they have. That's called hyperplasia. And the research suggests overwhelmingly that the majority of increased muscle mass, especially due to exercise, is due to an increase in muscle fiber size, not an increase in muscle fiber number. Now, muscles are composed of about 75% water, 10 to 15% contractile, or what are known as myofibrillar proteins, myofibrils, and about 5% non-contractile or sarcoplasmic proteins. Despite making up relatively small fraction of the muscle tissue, myofibrils occupy nearly 85% of the space inside a muscle cell, and the rest of the space is occupied by mitochondria, which are the energy powerhouses of the cell, and sarcoplasm. That's the fluid component that maintains the proper environment for the muscle fibers. Now, this study compared muscle fiber and myofibril characteristics in those who'd been training for a long time versus untrained individuals. And it was hypothesized that trained individuals would have larger and a greater number of muscle fibers, larger and a greater number of myofibrils, so more myofibrils per muscle fiber and in total, and smaller myofilament spacing, so a greater packing density of these myofilaments, these contractile elements of the muscle. And larger muscles would also correlate with the number of muscle fibers and myofibrils. So they took 16 individuals aged 18 to 40 who had trained for about 6 years or more, and they had been lifting weights at least twice per week during that time period. And they compared them to 13 untrained individuals. They did an MRI of their non-dominant arm, their biceps, brachii, to assess muscle cross-sectional area. And they also took a muscle biopsy of that same muscle to look at muscle fiber ultrastructure. So basically, how many myofilaments did it have? What's the packing density? They did a bunch of staining on it to ultimately give us the results. So speaking of results, first things first, the body mass in the trained individuals was about 18% larger in the trained folks than the untrained. And so when you're looking at all these numbers, one thing you would want to kind of take into consideration is that because the folks were bigger, that a lot of the numbers would be skewed. So they did correct for that for the rest of these numbers. So I'll just kind of gloss over that for now. Now, the biceps brachii was 70% greater in size in the trained individuals compared to the untrained individuals when normalized for body size. So no surprise, if you lift weights for a long period of time, you're likely to have bigger muscles than untrained individuals. I know, we could just end the podcast there. That was the takeaway. Great clinical pearl. The muscle fiber type, so whether they were type 1 or type 2, that proportion was basically the same between groups, which is just goes to show that it's very difficult to change, if not impossible, to change muscle fiber types via training. There's some fiber conversion types within the subset, but not you're not really changing type 1 to type 2 or type 2 to type 1. Fibers were much larger, muscle fibers were much larger in trained than untrained individuals, about 27% greater for type 1 fibers and about 31% larger for type 2 fibers. So on average, the muscle fibers were 30% larger in the trained individuals compared to the untrained. Now, the fiber number, the number of muscle fibers, was also seen to be about 34% greater in the trained individuals versus untrained individuals. Okay, so keep that fact in the back of your mind for the rest of the discussion here. And the myofibrils were actually smaller in the trained versus untrained individuals, but there was about 50% more of them. So basically, it looked like when they looked at it under a microscope that they had smaller myofibrils, but way more of them. Okay, so they were really tightly packed. So as far as the discussion of like this paper, effectively, they're suggesting, well, look, these trained individuals, they have way more muscle fibers than the untrained, which means there's either got to be some hyperplasia going on, so an increase in muscle fibers, or maybe the way that the muscle was actually biopsied, you know, maybe it's just looking, it just looks like there's way more muscle fibers, but there's not, right? And so they give this explanation of why they use the biceps. It's called a fusiform muscle, which means most of the muscle fibers run in parallel compared to like a pennate or highly angled muscle. And so it's suspected that that would produce less of this sort of artifact of like, oh yeah, well, you just cut the muscle, you took a biopsy of it, and it looks like there's way more muscle fibers, but there's not because you're really at an angle. They're saying, it's probably not that because we use the biceps. So it's probably hyperplasia. They don't come right out and say that, but they insinuate that that's what they're talking about here. However, they are quick to admit that this study was not longitudinal. They didn't take people from like untrained to trained and then count the muscle fibers. And they also say, hey, look, there's a lot of methodology problems here and like how you count muscle fibers, how you count, you know, measure their size and such. So we don't really know. So if somebody like is trying to use this paper to say, look, hyperplasia exists, it's like, well, it can't because they didn't measure, you know, amount of muscle fibers on day zero versus, you know, number of muscle fibers on day 120. So you can't use this, but this is more like a hypothesis generating type of study. As far as my take on this, there have been a lot of papers and review articles and op-eds and such kind of suggesting, hey, look, hyperplasia, as most people would say, can occur, but no one's ever shown it yet. And that doesn't mean that it can't exist. And, you know, I'm kind of the opinion that the human body has multiple redundant mechanisms for like survival and thriving in various environments. It seems unlikely to me that there would be like no element of hyperplasia at all that could ever happen in the skeletal muscle. I just don't think it's likely to be a big contributor to muscle size based on the current evidence. Now, Austin, is that kind of your understanding? Admitting that you don't find this interesting at all outside of life.
Well, that is correct. I think to your point that if it were a large contributor to muscle growth over time, we would probably have had an easier time showing it by now. So that it has been so difficult maybe suggests that it is either minor or not really a factor. It would be nice if we had imaging modalities that had sufficient resolution to see at the individual muscle fiber level, because then it would be a lot easier to do these kind of longitudinal studies with less of that potential, you know, artifact or bias from biopsy technique and things like that. Like if you could just do a scan, take a, you know, a voxel or like a volumetric pixel on a CT scan and just like identify the number of muscle fibers and then, you know, monitor an analogously sampled voxel over time on your CT scan or something and see an increase in the fiber density or something, that would be nice, because then that would obviate like how, what angle were you at and how did you stab the muscle and what section did you end up putting under the microscope and all this other stuff. That all those details are part of what makes this so much less interesting to me. But I think that, you know, your general take is seems reasonable to me, that it's either minor or not a huge contributor. And it would be, if we really wanted to get an answer to this, it would be great if we had ultra high resolution imaging methods that could be used longitudinally instead of this seemingly fraught method of muscle biopsies.
Yeah, muscle biopsies can be tough because, you know, by doing the biopsy itself, it changes how the muscle looks, like the fiber that you take, how it looks. So kind of difficult to really feel strongly about that. But it does bring it to maybe a more important, broader kind of point when it comes to generating hypotheses or even paradigms or heuristics, you know, that you're using. It's very difficult to say something never happens under any circumstance and like hanging your hat on that. You could say something like proportionally is less important, or something is maybe, you know, relatively rare or unlikely. Those are all like, you know, I know that people are like, ah, dumb doctor talk. You're just, you know, hedging your bets, or you don't want to be wrong. And it's like, yeah, well, it very few things related to human biology or human experience are like all or none. So it's really difficult to like say, yeah, this never happens or could never happen. You know, but with respect to this sort of idea that you can generate more muscle fibers, this de novo myofibrillogenesis has been studied in animals. And, you know, to the extent that you can accurately measure that, has not really been documented. No human studies have really been done on that. So still some unknowns there. Yeah. Overall, I found this paper interesting, like from an academic perspective, like, okay, like, hey, is hyperplasia, like, is that a thing that like happens? Do we have any better data on it? Which is why I wanted to review it. Turns out, the answer is not really, but you know, maybe in the future we can put this to bed once and for all. Although I don't think it practically changes what you would have people do, you know, which is much to your point from last week. You're like, reading these training related studies, I don't really know that anything new is going to come out and significantly change my mind for what I do. Rather, everything's got to be individualized to the results that are kind of demonstrated.
Mm-hmm. Yep, agree.
All right. Well, that's a wrap here on episode 302 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Just a reminder, we do have a lot of cool free resources over on our resource page. So just go to the barbellmedicine.com website, go to About Us, click resources, bunch of free tools that might help you on your health and fitness journey. Also, if you are an Android user, our app is available for free in the Google Play Store, and you can get the first free week of all of our templates on there if you're interested in sampling one of those. And if you're on the fence about what template to choose, we do have a template quiz that we've kind of created. It is in the description linked below. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated.
Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.